The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have a not that long of an agenda, and if it's possible if we get through, and we might not have to come back tomorrow, so I'm going to see if we can do this. I'm sure that... Okay, yeah. No, go ahead.
No, is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know other members have committees going on, so we won't have a full house here all morning, but we'll do what we can do. Representative Halverson is delayed, so I'm asking Representative Simon, who is a co-author of House File 637, if he would move and introduce the bill. And I understand this bill has to go to state government finance. Representative Simon, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it. I will move that House File 637 be recommended pass and re-refer to the Committee on State Government Finance. Members, House File 637, I'm pinch-hitting today, as the Chair said, for Representative Halverson. This is the product of the Election Integrity Task Force, which was appointed by Governor Dayton last year and included many members of the community. It included four legislators, one from each caucus. I represented House Democrats, Representative Mike Benson represented House Republicans, Senator Roger Chamberlain was the Senate Republican, and Senator Katie Sieben was the Senate Democrat. And this reflects the work of that task force. It was bipartisan. It was carried by Representative Mike Benson last session, and it passed here, but it got hung up in the Senate at the very end of the session. And so now we're back with, I think it's almost the exact same bill. There are some technical modifications. But to describe what it does, and what it does generally, members, is it has to do with the issue of felon voting. And this really was an area of common ground. No matter where you are or were on photo ID, no matter where you are or were on a variety of election issues, this is one where there was broad bipartisan agreement. On the issue of felon voting, we know that it sometimes happens and shouldn't happen, and we want to get to zero. And we think we can get to zero with some pretty straightforward changes in state law that will make it far, far less likely that felons vote or register to vote. And so there was agreement on that. And to walk through the bill and tell you a little bit more about the details, we have Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office, and we also have, of course, James Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney. But I think Ms. Fraser wants to discuss the bill's provisions, and then we'll go to Mr. Backstrom.
Very good. Ms. Fraser, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Representative Simon said, this bill is designed to make changes within the current system. It doesn't change anyone's voting rights. It is designed to ensure that those who do not have the right to vote are aware of that. It's designed to make sure that those who have regained the right to vote know that. And to ensure that there is data sharing at the state level so that election officials and prosecutors, if necessary, are aware of who does and does not have the right to vote, to try to prevent people from voting if they shouldn't, and to catch them if they do. So to walk through the bill section by section, Section 1 establishes an administrative procedure for cases in which someone who is believed to be ineligible to vote submits a voter registration application, allowing county auditors to provide the individual with notice they will not be processing the registration without further action on the part of the applicant. Current law requires that all applications be processed, so this is a common sense kind of stop in the process. Section 2 provides an affirmative defense to the crime of illegally registering to vote if the person has submitted a written request to have their voter registration withdrawn, has not been charged with a crime, and has not voted. It also changes illegally registering to vote for those who have not voted from a felony to a misdemeanor. Sections 3 and 7 provide the section of the Secretary of State with data on felons currently serving probation both before and after elections, so voter records can be flagged to prevent felons from voting or unflagged if they have completed their sentences, and so that any felons who do vote can be caught. Election officials do not currently have access to this data. We currently have access to data from the Department of Corrections on people who are under the jurisdiction of the commissioner, but not those who are on probation. It also requires the Secretary of State to send written notice to felons prior to each state general election to warn them not to vote, as well as notices to those who have completed their sentences that their right to vote has been restored. Section 4 moves responsibility for investigating voting violations from county attorneys to law enforcement agencies and requires county attorneys to follow prosecuting standards currently set by the American Bar Association, or by the amendment, the National County Attorneys Association, as they review and charge alleged violations of election law. I'm sure that Mr. Backstrom can provide further information about that section in particular. Section 5 prohibits the sending or delivery of absentee ballots to anyone who provides the address of a facility that houses only felony level offenders. Section 6 provides that a signature on the roster is legally sufficient evidence of an intent to vote. And Section 8 requires that probation agreements for felony level offenses include written notice that the individual is prohibited from voting. So that's kind of an overview of the task force's recommendations and the bill in front of you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
And I just thank you, Ms. Fraser. Mr. Waltz, can you just briefly explain the fiscal note and how it does or doesn't relate to this committee?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note, corrections had put in one position to take care of duties relating to this bill, which would be paid for by an interagency agreement with the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State would receive the revenues and make a transfer of the required dollars to the Department of Corrections to hold the Department of Corrections harmless. The Secretary of State also has some ancillary costs for, I believe, postage. The total cost of this bill is $95,000 in 14, $135,000 in 15, and that would all be borne by the Secretary of State.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Fraser, who's next then to you? Oh, Representative Halverson, welcome to the committee. I didn't see you there for a second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to you and to the members of the committee for allowing one of my co-authors, Representative Simon, to introduce this bill, and thanks to Ms. Fraser. We do have an amendment to the bill that might
be... Oh, yes, we do. That's great. Get that. I'm sorry. We should have taken care of that first thing. So, Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Well, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails, and Representative Simon moves the A2 amendment to also get the bill in the shape that the author wants it. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Now, maybe you can tell us what the amendments just did.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendments reflect two things that came out of the conversation that we had in the Elections Committee, and that unfortunately did not get added, but they're reflected in our minutes, so thank you for helping us clean that up. The discussion, and our county attorney, Jim Backstrom, can describe this in greater detail, speaks to the question of what standards prosecutors need to be using in order to prosecute any cases of voter fraud. And the committee came to the decision that it is appropriate for prosecutors to be prosecuting to their correct prosecutorial standards and not to standards that are artificially set by the legislature. You do have in your packet information from Mankato of a issue that prosecutors are having to prosecute a elderly woman charged with voter fraud because of the way the law is currently written. Prosecutor has said, and I believe you have that in your packets, that under normal circumstances, this isn't a case that she would take up under her prosecutorial standards, but because of the way Minnesota law is written specifically around election law, she's having to convene a grand jury and charge this elderly woman who mistakenly voted. And with that, I would like to invite Jim Backstrom to speak to this portion of the bill.
Mr. Backstrom, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the National District Attorneys Association. It's my privilege to be here with you again today to support this bill. I want to first of all thank Representative Halverson, Representative Simon, and the other authors of this bill for their leadership on this issue. I also want to thank the Governor's Task Force on Election Integrity for their hard work that has led to this bill being put together, and also thank Secretary of State Mark Ritchie, who's put a lot of time and effort into trying to improve our election laws in our state. This is an important issue. Voting is one of the most important responsibilities of a citizen. And it's important that it be done appropriately and lawfully. We do support, as county attorneys in our state, these changes that are in this bill. I'll specifically address Section 5 in a moment, but actually I want to point out to this committee, as I did the last one, that county attorneys have actually adopted support for a broader proposal that may be before you at some time. It's called the North Dakota Model, which would allow anyone convicted of a felony to vote once they cease to be incarcerated, either in a prison or a local county jail. That is not in this bill. I just mentioned that because it is the position of the county attorneys that we could perhaps even broaden these changes a little bit farther and further the opportunities for offenders who've been convicted of crimes to rehabilitate themselves into society and to become law-abiding citizens. I would like, if I could, Mr. Chair, to address Section 5, I believe it's Section 5 of the bill, Section 4 of the bill.
Very good.
Which addresses Minnesota Statute 201.275. This has been amended, I'm told, by the, I think both of the amendments you passed were in reflection to the same language, but it's the A2 amendment, I'm told by Representative Halverson, the last one passed, which is the controlling language, and that basically in the last few lines, as you say, it changes this statute, which for years has been really an inappropriate and quite frankly provision that violates the ethical responsibilities that prosecutors in our system have, because a prosecutor cannot, as this statute previously said, without these changes, file a complaint or be forced to file a complaint by law if there's probable cause for initiating that prosecution, because it's the ethical responsibility of a prosecutor under our system of justice to make our own independent review of the facts and evidence in the case and make our own independent conclusion that we have enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict that person at trial. And if we ourselves do not believe that to be the case, even if there is probable cause, which is the standard for arresting someone, a county attorney or any prosecutor cannot file a criminal charge. So this statute really was in dire need of being changed, and I appreciate the effort with this bill to do that. As you will see, it eliminates that mandatory language. It substitutes that if an investigation is presented to us, that we will process that investigation, review that case according to the generally applicable standards regarding the prosecutorial functions and duties of a county attorney. It also makes one other additional important change, and that is that it takes away from the county attorneys the duty to investigate, because county attorneys in our state do not investigate crime. It's the law enforcement agencies, our law enforcement partners that we work with that investigate criminal activity. So that's another important change that places the burden where it properly should be. So these are very important changes in this particular section. I want to thank again Representative Halverson for her leadership on this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions of Mr. Backstrom or Ms. Fraser? Representative Cornish.
Did we, Mr. Chair, did we save any money in the fiscal note by lowering the penalty from a felony to a misdemeanor, or did that garner any savings to wash out the expense of the bill, or
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, in the fiscal note, both the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, the Public Defense Board, and sentencing guidelines put in a fiscal note of zero, that the impacts on them would all be immaterial.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, question I have is with changing the investigation of these offenses to the appropriate law enforcement agency, which I believe is the right thing to do, as the county attorney should not investigate, as they are the one to do the prosecution, and the sheriff's department or the police department are the ones that should do the investigation of these. You had mentioned that other bill that's been I don't believe it's been to this committee yet. Do you believe that would change the position of the county attorney's office in reference to that other bill? I have been contacted by a few different county attorneys on that issue.
Who is the question for? Mr. Baxter?
Mr. Baxter.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, if the other bill you're referring to is the one that establishes the what I call the North Dakota model, is that what?
That is correct.
That bill, I'm not completely familiar with where that's at in the legislative process, if it, in fact it's even been introduced. I think it has, but I'm not entirely sure. That's a separate bill. It covers, you know, separate things, so it really would be unaffected by the passage of this.
And Representative Johnson, we did hear that bill, and it's it passed and was referred to the Committee on Elections. Any other questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And member, Mr. Chair, and I had to step out for a minute to make a call. Mr. Baxter, you may have addressed this already. I asked Representative Hellstrom, you said that you had indicated that the county attorneys are in support of House File 637.
Yes, we are.
Mr.
And
Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Baxter, can you, maybe you already stated this, and I apologize for stepping out, but how about the county election officials? Did you indicate where they are on this?
Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, I am unaware of what position they have taken on the matter.
Ms. Fraser, do you know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, local election officials are supportive of this bill because they believe it would give them the tools necessary to help prevent people from voting who shouldn't vote and to catch them if they do.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Halverson, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the members of the committee for hearing this testimony. I appreciate your consideration of this bill. It has been a long time in progress. Many of you may have seen this bill last year as it was brought forward by Representative Michael Benson and has gone through three committees already last legislative session. And what you're seeing is what the legislature worked on last year. With the exception of the minor amendments that we made today. This is good legislation that's going to move our election system into greater integrity. It's going to reflect what our local election officers and what our local county attorneys and prosecutors are wanting to see in order to most effectively take action in cases of ineligible voting. It also provides an element of fairness to people who may have been incarcerated and may have learned during their incarceration that they were ineligible to vote, but somehow were not notified after they were put out on parole. And so this notification will make prosecutorial standards and intent much clearer in anybody who tends to vote illegally and brings an element of fairness to our election system.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 637 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance as amended. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Lesch, House File 828. Members, for those of you who came in late, I am trying to rush through these. If you have objections to that, let me know. But I'm thinking if it's possible we could get through these bills, we might not have to come back tomorrow. So. I'm not saying we should not. Representative Lesch, House File 828.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I ask that House File 828 be recommended to pass and referred to somewhere else.
Yeah, both to the General Register.
General Register is a great idea, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have with me Ms. Katie Engler. This is an agency bill. She can walk through the changes we're making.
Ms. Engler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm going to move through this quickly and then allow you to ask any questions that you might have. The first change in Section 1 appears on the second page of the bill and is one of the technologically-based changes. It used to be that fingerprints arrived at the Bureau on what are known as fingerprint cards. Now 98% of our fingerprints arrive electronically, and so the language that's being changed is about when someone's eligible to have their record at the Bureau completely destroyed. It's very difficult to return electronic things, and so what we're doing is changing it so that when someone is eligible, we will destroy their electronic fingerprints rather than return them to them. Section 2 is the first...
So what does that mean? So when they're eligible to have them destroyed, so they... Explain that a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, if you go back to the beginning of page 1, beginning in line 1.22, if someone has basically an arrest record, it says they have not been convicted of a felony or gross misdemeanor within 10 years, and charges were dismissed or the prosecutor declined to file charges, and they have a time period where they've kept their record clean, they're eligible to have their record at the Bureau destroyed.
And just because I've had a few constituents, or maybe just because I'm chair, that have people from the state that have asked me about that. And so what's the process for them doing that? Do they contact the BCA and say they're...
Yes, they need to make a request to us, Mr. Chair, and we will review the record and determine if, in fact, they meet the statutory requirements.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Section 2 is the first of a series of changes related to our secure network that we use to communicate amongst criminal justice agencies in the state. Section 2 is, again, a technology change, recognizing that communications no longer necessarily move over wires, but rather have moved to the cloud. Section 3 changes the definition of a criminal justice agency by doing two things. It recognizes that we have federal criminal justice agency partners in the state that connect to the network, as well as those who serve portions of Minnesota but from offices located outside of Minnesota's boundaries. Section 4 makes some conforming changes to the definition of non-criminal justice agency to match changes to criminal justice agency definition, but here the agencies that are entitled to be on the network are only Minnesota government offices. Section 5 has several changes. The first, in line 3.10, is just an update of a federal statutory reference. In line 1.2, we're tightening the definition of an emergency to one that's been declared by the governor rather than someone deciding that a traffic accident is an emergency. And then the other changes begin in line 3.22. The first is that there have been some instances where you as the legislature have decided that a government agency is entitled to access to data and repositories operated by the Bureau, but they have not made similar changes to this communication network statute. And so what the language in Clause 8 would do is say, once you've decided that a government office is entitled to access to the data, they would also be entitled to use the network. And Clause 9, beginning in 3.25, would allow the court to use their secure connection for civil purposes. On page 4, we have some new provisions beginning in 4.3 that establish the baseline for the criminal justice agencies and the non-criminal justice agencies who will be using the network. They have to agree to our policies on how they get access to and use of the data. They have to meet our security requirements, pay any required fees, and have their employees subject to a fingerprint-based state and national background check. In paragraph F, we provide that non-criminal justice agencies who get access to data retrieved over the network or who have access to the network itself and who are going to evaluate others based on their criminal history for some right, a license, a job, housing, or something similar. This is what we call the check the checker language. In other words, if they're evaluating other people's backgrounds, they also ought to be subject to a background check. And paragraph G is the process that's required in order to conduct the state and national check. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has some language that it requires for civil use of the National Criminal History Records Repository, and the statute has to be approved by the U.S. Attorney General before those checks can occur. And so the language in paragraph D meets those requirements. Section 6 is language that we've been working on with our local partners. Right now, cities and counties can use the Minnesota Criminal History Repository to conduct background checks for applicants for employment, volunteers, and for licenses issued by the city or county. And what we've been asking these cities and counties to do is to enact an ordinance setting this up. And what we're doing is, in essence, replacing all of those ordinances with a state statute. This will allow the cities and counties to save the cost of the ordinance process, which includes publication. Section 7, which begins at the bottom of page 5, and Section 8 both relate to firefighter background checks. If you look in page on page 6 in Section 8, in line 6.11, some of the struck language talks about developing a plan for doing these checks. That plan was developed quite some time ago. We're now putting the plan into the statute. It provides for both a state criminal history check and a federal criminal history check at the time that an applicant for employment in a fire department has either lived outside of Minnesota for less than 5 years or when the chief requests it. The remainder of the language is that's what is required in order to set up the process for the check to occur. Section 9 relates to permits and licenses for explosives. You'll see that what is now subdivision 1 lists what disqualifies a person from getting those licenses or permits. What subdivision 2 is provides the process by which you determine whether or not someone is disqualified. Again, it is language that meets state and federal requirements for those checks. Sections 10 and 11 are, again, providing the process for determining disqualification. In this case, the context is liquor license checks. Section 10 covers wholesale liquor licenses issued by the Department of Public Safety. Section 11 covers retail liquor licenses, which can be issued either by the Commissioner of Public Safety, a county, or a city. And the last section, 12 on page 10, repeals a background check for the McGruff Safe House program. We were going to fix this because all the statute says is thou shalt do a background check. But we learned that the McGruff Safe House program doesn't exist any longer, so we thought it better to come to you with a repeal. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Just a quick question, Ms. English. What is the broad title of our information system at the BCA? I mean, there's Minsis and what? There's all of these different. Is there one broad name for this that all of this data is?
Mr. Chair, the Bureau operates several different repositories, each with their own name. The part of the Bureau that runs those systems is known as Minnesota Justice Information Services, or MINJIS. MINSIS refers to the Minnesota Court Integration System, which is operated by the judicial branch. So we don't really have one overarching name for all the repositories. It's just they're all operated through this single division at the Bureau.
So the court provides all its information to MINSIS, and then MINJIS is all of the rest of the criminal data and background check data and fingerprint data?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to hesitate because you used the word all. The Bureau is required to receive from local law enforcement booking information for all felonies, gross misdemeanors, and what are known as targeted misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. So not every misdemeanor offense is submitted to the Bureau. Some agencies choose to submit all their offenses. Others choose to meet the statutory mandate. So the use of the word all is maybe a little too broad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, whenever I hear the word background checks, I go into instant vapor lock.
Well,
I was wondering
Tuesday.
If anything in this, and I'm just worried about this bill being a vehicle, does anything in this bill address anything at all about a chief or a sheriff's authority in the issuance or background check to do with a permit to purchase or permit to carry or anything like that in any of these background check qualifiers?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, no.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, this is telling a lot of local folks to do stuff. Did you consult with the committee that has jurisdiction over local units of government to make sure they didn't need to see this?
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lesch, if I vote to send it to the General Register, will you consult with them to make sure they don't need to see it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes.
Representative Lesch, other questions? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I think, is for Ms. Engler, but I'm looking at page 6 on line 6.136.1.14. And I will disclose that there are certain cases when I support background checks. However, my question is, I understand the need and the desire for a background check must be conducted on all applicants for employment. I'm with you there. But then it goes on to say, and may be conducted on current employees at a fire department, but it doesn't say why, and it doesn't say what the trigger would be. My assumption would be that it would be in connection with, say, a promotional exam or moving into some different type of job, but it doesn't say that. So if you can convince me that that wouldn't subject us to just random background checks for no real apparent reason, I might be more comfortable.
Ms. Engler.
If I could,
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, this was originally raised to me by a police chief. I can't remember who it was, but it was several years back, who had a member of his department, he found out through different channels that had been charged with arson in a different jurisdiction. But he had no recourse to run a check to confirm or verify that why do I have a firefighter working in my department that's been charged with arson? So that's where this originally came from for me several years back, but maybe Ms. Engler has a different explanation for that.
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, this is the current, well, let me back up. The superintendent was required to create a plan to conduct background checks. That is currently in place, and it includes this requirement for checks of current employees. And we have, in fact, reviewed the language with the Fire Chiefs Association, and they agree that this is the process that they currently have in place. It's my understanding that the checks on current employees are at the discretion of the chief.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other discussion? Representative Lesch, did all of the, I can't remember the name of the organization, but did the sort of the organizations that are concerned about data and privacy have a chance to look at this bill at all before it came to civil law?
Mr. Chair, one moment.
The subcommittee or?
That's right.
Did they?
Chair, when it came through data practices.
I got it. That's good. Cool. All right. Anything else? Questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Engler. Representative Lesch, you want to renew your motion?
I would, Mr. Chair. I ask that it be recommended to pass. House file 828 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? That motion prevails. You know, I should have asked, was there anyone that had any opposition to that bill? Sorry about that. I forget. Okay, Representative Scott, I think you're next here. Yes. Representative Scott, welcome to the committee. Representative Cornish will move House File 804 with a motion to pass and be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Payman, or Mr. Chair, excuse me. This morning I'm talking to you about House File 804. Currently, the Department of Corrections has the ability to and the permission to track employment information from DEED for felons that are both pre- and post-incarceration. But they do not currently have the authorization to track that same information on felons that are parolees. So what this bill would do is allow them to access that information from DEED, and it has to do with the training and employment training that they receive while they're incarcerated, and it's really important data for the Department of Corrections. And this morning I have Ms. Kirshner here to testify to tell you a little bit more about that.
Ms. Kirshner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Kirshner. I'm the Director of Planning and Performance with the Department of Corrections. Currently, the department does have direct access to employment data from DEED, but only for those offenders who've received a prison sentence. This information is important to us because we're able to evaluate the effectiveness of our education and our vocational programs to basically find out what works to assist offenders in getting and keeping jobs when they're in the community. We currently do not have direct access for those offenders who receive a community or probation sentence, and we're requesting similar access directly with DEED for those individuals and their employment history so we can also effectively evaluate the programs that we offer for community-based offenders. So I'm open to any questions the committee might have.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Questions to Ms. Kirshner? I understand, Representative Scott, this was heard in civil law. Okay. Are there any questions of the author? Is there anyone who wishes to oppose this bill who would like to speak to the committee? Representative Scott, closing comments?
Nope, I just asked for your support of this bill.
Representative Cornish will renew his motion that House File 804 pass and be referred to the General Register. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Scott.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Hillstrom, you're next.
I would move that House File 590 be recommended to pass and I believe sent to the General Register. I don't know if it needs to go anywhere else.
I think it's we've requested.
Mr. Chair, members, a fiscal note has been requested on this bill so far. The only agency to respond was the public defenders, who responded with a zero fiscal note, assuming it wouldn't place any additional burden on them. There's been no response from sentencing guidelines as of yet as to whether or not this would materially increase the number of incarcerated individuals in the state.
So, Representative Hillstrom, what if we just lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, and then if it doesn't, if it comes up zero or negligible, we'll refer it to the floor?
That's fine, Mr. Chair. And I also have an amendment, actually, to take the felony provision out of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is that, do we have the amendment, or is it an oral amendment?
It's a written amendment, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, it should have been submitted to the committee previously.
Okay, we did.
Okay. All right.
So, Representative Hillstrom, you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment. Members, this is to take the felony provision out of the bill after speaking with the Senate. If we want to get the bill heard, we needed to take the felony provision out, so that's what we're doing.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Tell us about the bill, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this is a governor's initiative. This was brought to me through the Metropolitan Council, and so I will just turn it over to them in order to be timely, Mr. Chair.
Great. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. What we have is an initiative between the Council and our ATU, Amalgamated Transit Union, our drivers, that we have been working on for the past few years in order to raise the penalty for persons who assault or throw bodily fluids upon our drivers in the course of them performing their duties as operating our transit vehicles. And what I'd like to do is to present a short video for the committee. There is some language in here that isn't probably the most appropriate, but if the committee doesn't mind, I'll play the video and just be aware that there's some rough language in there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Otherwise, I had told Mr. Shetton that he could turn the sound off if the chair would prefer that.
What was the problem with it, I guess?
There's a vulgar language that is in addition to the assaults that are going on.
Oh, we're all adults here. We'll listen. But if people would turn their cell phones off so we could listen to it, that'd be helpful.
Okay, members, Mr. Chair, that is the video that we wanted to share to just show some of the instances that our operators have to put up with. With me, I have our Metro Transit Police Chief, former Senator Johnny Harrington, and we have Michelle Summers, who's the president of our transit union, as well as a number of drivers for Metro Transit are here to support the bill, and I think would like to share a couple words. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chief Harrington.
Chief, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee. Mission of Metro Transit Police is to protect our community through problem solving, and we believe that this bill does moves that in the right direction. One of the most important things we can do to protect our community is, in fact, to protect the operators of transit, the bus drivers, the men and women who operate the buses, the light rail, and the North Star Alliance in the metro area. The danger that assaults on drivers presents to the general community, to the passengers and to the drivers, I think is pretty evident from the video. If you can imagine being spit on, the natural reaction for all of us when someone does something like that is to turn our head, to move away, to try and to avoid that. Except you can't do that when you're driving a bus. You have 70 to 150 people on the bus. You have a multi-tonnage vehicle that's moving through heavy traffic, and you can't avoid the blow. You can't avoid the spit. When someone assaults a driver, they're not just assaulting a driver. They're, in fact, putting at jeopardy the lives of everybody that's on that vehicle. And in addition to those folks, if the driver was to lose control of the vehicle, was to try to avoid the blow, turn their head, lose control of the vehicle, they also put at risk anyone that's walking on our streets, anyone that's that's driving alongside of our vehicles. And so we believe that increasing the penalty so that assaults on drivers is good public safety. It'll be good for the safety of the drivers, good for the safety of the passengers, and good for the general public. In 2012, there were 129 assaults on drivers committed in the metro area, of which we made arrests on 43. The vast majority of these were, in fact, assaults that didn't fit any general category of the assault statute as it's currently configured. They were spitting. They were people that threw things at the driver but didn't necessarily hit them. But those assaults were nonetheless very detrimental to the public safety. I will also just note that when we look at who's driving our buses and who seems to be the most oftentimes victimized by this, the average age of our victims of assault are 56 years old. The average age of our suspects are oftentimes juveniles, the average age about 24 years old. Metro Transit Police supports this bill. We believe it's good for public safety. We believe it's good public policy.
Questions for Chief Harrington? Mr. Kiefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Does this go into school buses, too, and do you have any trouble on school buses?
Chief Farrington.
Representative Kitmeyer, Mr. Chair, this bill simply reflects Metro. Kiefer, sorry. I'm sorry. Now I feel really, really bad. different body entirely, too. So, no, this bill does not impact school buses. It was particularly brought as a agency bill by Metro Transit. We do interact with school children, especially in Minneapolis, where the Minneapolis school system is using Metro Transit vehicles for doing their senior high schools, but it would not necessarily impact school buses.
You have another, why am I blanking here? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any way you could squeeze taxi drivers into this as well?
Chief, you can respond if you want. I don't think the bill is...
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that was our intention, but we are open to the conversation if the body pleases.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Chef. Neuberger, I can respond to that. When we presented this legislation to the governor, specifically to Metro Transit Police, I think that there's always an opportunity to have further discussion, but for the purposes of the council, we have to work under the understanding of what we've presented to the administration, but that does not mean that the legislature can't choose to broaden the conversation regarding this, but for the purposes of our bill, it relates to Metro Transit.
Mr. Shenton, I'm going to put you on the spot rather than the chief. Do you think that our Metro Transit Police Department has sufficient resources to ensure that there's bus safety, both for the drivers as well as for passengers, and LRT, I should say?
Mr. Chair and members, I would say yes. I would also say that what you'll see today in the governor's proposed supplemental budget, that there will be a significant increase in funding for Metro Transit, for our transit lines, for our transit ways, that will also allow us to grow our safety efforts related to transit and LRT lines, commuter rail lines, our transit lines. I can appreciate your question. I will tell you that that we are comfortable with where we're at, but thank you for putting me in this position.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, as I read this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but does this bill only apply to transit operators within the metro area?
Mr. Shenton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. It only applies to transit operators in the metropolitan area. We have had other questions related to this, and regarding the taxi question, and for transit systems outside the metro area, the council takes every effort to only suggest things related to the council's purposes, because oftentimes there are questions about whether the council is trying to expand authorities, and since this specifically applies to Metro Transit police and the Metro Transit system, it only applies here. But I'm sure the folks who represent the Minnesota Public Transit Association, if they would like to be added to this legislation, we'd be more than happy to see that legislation expanded. However, at this point, it only applies to metropolitan area transit.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you for that. And to be clear, so I understand, and I apologize, but this particular statute, this isn't just enforced by Metro Transit Police, correct?
Mr. Shenton.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it wouldn't be. It isn't specific to Chapter 473, which is the Met Council language. It is in the criminal code, so I think that an interpretation could be looked at all transit ways, but I would leave that up to Mr. Diebel if he would like
Diebel,
to.
Diebel, can you clarify that, or are you ready? Ms. Berrios?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that's corrected since it's in 609, and a police officer could enforce this as well.
Just a final comment then, Mr. Chair. I just think, and I think it's a good bill, quite frankly. I agree with it, and I understand why it's written the way it is, but I think it should be applied on a statewide basis. That's just a comment.
Did you have any more testimony?
Mr. Chair, we have Michelle Summers, who's the president of our of our transit union, and we have just a couple drivers, so we'll keep it very short, who'd like to testify relating to why we're bringing this bill forward.
Very good. Ms. Summers?
Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Michelle Summers, and I represent the operators at Metro Transit. I have with me today a few operators that have dealt with this issue, and not only, as far as the resources, I would actually like to answer that question. I don't believe they do. I believe that they need to increase the police force with full-time operators that, full-time police officers that can help us, because sometimes there's 20-minute response, and it's not the fault of the police. It's because they don't have enough staff. But I will just turn it over for time here and let the operator speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to address this. My name is Kathy Nisler. I am driver 6248. I've been with Metro Transit for 21 years. January 5th, I was assaulted, and my head was badly beaten in by three young females. And this happened about 12:35 in the morning. It took me at least seven weeks out of work to recover from this. It's not only very upsetting and to get assaulted like this, but also to be spitted upon is just as severe as it would be on a physical attack, as far as I'm concerned. Not only do we need to increase the penalties, we need those laws enforced to let the people know that this behavior will not be tolerated at all. Thank you.
Ma'am, could you just give your name for the record? I didn't get it.
I'm sorry. My name is Kathy Nisler.
Nisler. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You.
And you are?
Hi. I'm Vanetta Cotton.
Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me address you guys. I've been driving for Metro Transit 7 years and a little bit over. But I've been spit on while doing a job, driving, answered a few questions. I guess the passenger sure didn't like the tone of my question answering, spit on me. And she ran off. There's pretty much nothing you can do once they do spit on you. You can't avoid it. You can't run away from it. It happens. And unfortunately, if you do try to, what your first response would be to defend yourself, it doesn't really go your way. So we do need stricter punishments, because it's like they know if they do spit on us or whatever, they'll go get a slap on the wrist and they can come back on the bus and continue to do it again. But if we let them know that's not okay, then maybe it'll go down some and they won't do it as much.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Sir, your name is?
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. My name is Kevin Brett. I've been driving for Metro Transit for 9 years. I just want to tell you that we are husbands, we are wives, we are brothers, sisters, friends, and I believe no one should be going through what we go through to do our job. And the thing I want to say is, like, when you get spit on, it's really demeaning, it's invading, it's really, really, it stays for weeks just to think about it, you know. As an adult, you don't really appreciate, but I believe we just got used to it, and that's not okay. And I appreciate if you guys do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Shatton.
Mr. Chair and members, I would just like to clarify my comments earlier regarding Representative Simonson's question. On the bill, lines 1.21, it defines public transit as a metropolitan area, which is provided by the council or other providers of regional public transit. So if we were to want it to expand to other public transit authorities, we'd need to make that amendment. At least that's the way I interpret it, Mr. Chair.
So if the Duluth Transit Authority wanted to participate.
Yep. But Mr. Chair, members, I think it would be, and I can leave this up to council, but I think it would be fairly easy to have it expanded to any type of Minnesota public transit authority.
Yeah, Mr. Wells, does that change then our fiscal note if we included transit authorities outside the metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair and members, generally these fiscal notes are based on how many people will be convicted and how much time they will do in state prisons. If there is no felony provision, I'm not sure that it would have a material impact.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, also Chief, want to make a brief comment for the Metro Transit Police Department. I know quite a few of the members that I work with them in other departments, both, and I know both quite a few of your full-time and also your part-time officers. I commend what your department does. They do a fantastic job. As far as the bus drivers, being in law enforcement, no matter, we can never have enough law enforcement, just because no matter what happens, we can only be in one place at one time. I wish it was possible that we could be everywhere at once, but unfortunately that is not possible. Representative Hillstrom, I was looking at this. We have a lot of other regional transit operators and in different regions of the state. Before the gentleman there with you mentioned it, I was looking at this, see if you'd be willing to make a quick oral amendment on line 1.22 or 1.21 and 1.22 and also in 1.24, removing within the metropolitan area so this could be used statewide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no objection to that if that's the direction the committee wanted to go. This was an agency bill, and I just was supporting the position of the governor, but I don't see any reason not to do it.
Mr. Shetton, what's your opinion on this? I mean, it came from...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would say that the council and the administration would be open to accepting that as a very friendly amendment.
Okay, then do you want to... can staff read us the amendment then? Based on Representative Johnson's suggestion, motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on line 1.21, delete within the metropolitan, page 1, line 2.2 and 2.3, delete those two lines, and insert a semicolon. On line 1.24, delete within the metropolitan area.
What does she say?
And delete lines 2.4 and 2.5. I believe that's it.
Okay, is that... I think you missed...
Yeah, Mr. Well, Chair, members,
wouldn't area have to go to within the metropolitan area? Did you say that? 1.121 and 1.22? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what else, Ms. Perius? Was that it?
Yes.
Okay. Is that, Representative Johnson, does that reflect your motion then?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Are there questions on the Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just reading here between 1.7 and 1.12 as it's talking about operating a transit vehicle. There's several references to that in the statute 609. The definition, therefore, of a transit operator, my question being ignorant of 609, is that only public transit, or would this also extend to private bus companies? We have a number of charter bus companies, and I'm wondering if this transit has become a generic term, that if it's going to extend to them as well.
Ms. Pierce?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe this would just extend to public transit because the definition of transit operator states of a transit vehicle, and then it defines public transit, light rail transit, Met Council, special transportation services, and commuter rail service. So I believe this is only public.
Mr. Shenton, are you okay with it? Is that what?
Yep, Mr. Chair members, yes.
Okay, so we have the Johnson Amendment before us. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the Johnson Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
That motion prevails. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Then, does anyone want to speak in opposition or support of the bill from the audience? I'm sorry, I keep forgetting to ask that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Edward Reynoso, I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and we would like to gladly offer support for the bill as we represent many members at DTA. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else who wishes to speak in favor or opposition to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So is my motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion?
As amended, yes.
As amended, yeah. Mr. Chair.
And then if as soon as we get a green light, we'll just go to the general register. So any discussion? Well, the chair will lay the bill over. All right. We're going to depend on fiscal staff here, and we're going to say it doesn't have a fiscal note. So, Representative Hillstrom, you want to move your bill to the floor?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 590 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register as amended.
As amended. Very good. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
We are waiting for Representative Mahoney, who I believe is here. And as he's coming forward, just wanted to announce that next we will... Representative Johnson's bill apparently has made deadline in the Senate. Therefore, we won't need to hear it tomorrow. And if we finish Representative Mahoney's bill today, we won't need to come in tomorrow. House File 237 will be heard on Tuesday. That will be the only bill on the agenda for Tuesday. It's after consultation with Representative Cornish. We will not have public testimony on House File 237, but any new language or amendments, we will have discussion, and we will have the ability to ask questions of the author or people who can help us understand new language in 237 and any amendments. Very good. So, Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could ask someone to...
The chair will move House File 690 to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 690 is generally referred to as the Ban the Box Bill. What this bill does is... I'll back up. A number of years ago, not that many, we removed what they call the box on all of our state employment applications. City of St. Paul and Minneapolis have also removed this box. What this box is they check where on an application it says, are you a felon? And if you don't check that, you're lying. If you are a felon and you don't check that, you're lying and reason to be dismissed from employment. What this bill does is remove that first blush question of are you a felon. It does not, and I want to repeat and very strongly emphasize, does not prohibit an employer, once they have made the decision to interview you, from asking that question. There are certainly certain places where you do not want someone with a criminal record working. I get that, and I understand that. But what this bill does when we ban that box and remove that first question is give a convicted felon who has served their time and paid their restitution to society the opportunity to rejoin society with a job. One of the biggest problems that we have with felons is when they cannot find gainful employment, they end up back in the system. I don't want to put an overburden on private employers or anyone. But what I do want is I want to give the 1 in 5 convicted persons in this state an opportunity to rejoin rejoin society as productive members of society. And with that, I've read the bill, understand it pretty well, but I'm going to turn it over to the advocates because they are even more passionate about this particular bill than I am. So with that, I would like to turn it over to the testifier, Mr. Hasse. Hazi, and my other witness, the Commissioner of Human Rights, Kevin Lindsay.
Hazi, you're going first?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mark Hazi, Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice and co-chair of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. Thank you, members. I'm happy to be here again. I just wanted to make sure something's clear regarding Representative Mahoney's statements on the bill. I know he understands the bill, but sometimes we get into this convicted felon and felon language. This really applies to people with any kind of a criminal record. And the 1 in 5 number that, you know, 1 in 5 people nationally and an estimated 1 in 4 people in Minnesota have some kind of a criminal record, and that could be just an arrest.
Hasty, just hang on a second. Do any of you have your cell phones on? Because we're really getting a lot of feedback here. Thank you.
Thank you. So, you know, this applies to people who may have just been arrested. That record becomes public, and in many cases, that can be a hindrance to people getting employment. And as Representative Mahoney said, this just takes it off that initial application, which has been done by many jurisdictions. Many employers currently don't ask the question, but many do, and then it can hold people back when they really can be good employees. And it holds us back as a state because we know we're going to have a workforce shortage in the future, and we need to have people who are employed to their full potential to do that. If members have questions about the specifics of the language, I don't know if you want me to go through the actual bill. One thing I would note, if this question comes up fairly often, if you look at line 2.5. It says, this section does not prohibit an employer from notifying applicants that law or the employer's policy will disqualify an individual with particular criminal history background from employment in particular positions. In other words, what that says, you know, we want people to have fair notice. We don't want people applying for jobs wasting their time and the employer's time applying for jobs that they may not qualify for, because as you already heard, an employer can still choose not to hire somebody with a criminal record. And so they could put on their application, you know, criminal history may result in, depending on the position, may result in disqualification for employment. They could be more specific. They could say if you have a fraud or theft background, that may disqualify you from employment in this position. I also want to note that, a couple things. There's a broad coalition of groups that support this work, the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. I think in the Senate we had a letter today earlier from the Minnesota Catholic Conference and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. They follow this procedure and they also see it as a public safety step forward. And then the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce had opposed the bill, and we've worked with them, and I want to thank them and their staff for working closely with us to find language that we have in the bill now that has allowed them to be neutral on the bill. And that language, originally we had in the remedies, we had attorney's fees and injunctive relief, and now we have administrative fines that the bill wouldn't go into effect until January 1st of 2014. And then for the first year, the Department of Human Rights could issue a warning, and if the employer is not in a warning 30 days later, then they could be fined up to $500 per incident, but a maximum of $500 per each calendar month. I think that's all I have.
Mr. Hasty, a quick question for you or Representative Mahoney. Since we did this, adopted this for public employers in 2009, maybe you said this and I missed it, but do we have any research to indicate that the objectives for public employment have been met that we can examine for private employers, employees?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please
members of the
yourself.
Committee. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. The issue surrounding this has been one that we have been interested in and been in dialogue with. And to your question, we did have a conversation with officials from the City of St. Paul and the City of Minneapolis and asked them their experience after 364 was passed. And their experience has been positive and that they have seen an increase in the hiring of individuals and none of the detriment that potentially was out there in some people's mind by the passage of that legislation.
Okay. We have questions. Commissioner, do you have a presentation beyond what my question?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission did issue new guidance on the use of criminal background history by private employers, and that guidance was issued April 25th of last year. And in that report, there was information was submitted by the Department of Justice. And in the information submitted by the Department of Justice, 92 million Americans have a criminal background history. And to this point, as it relates to an arrest versus convictions, further information submitted by the Department of Justice, looking at just 1 year, 2009, of the arrests that occurred in that year, 15% of the arrests were for violent crimes, 85% were for nonviolent crimes. So the vast majority of arrests which occur within our country are for nonviolent offenses. The additional information which I think is relevant for this committee to hear is that the vast majority of arrests don't subsequently get uploaded as it relates to whether a conviction occurred for that arrest. So let me play that out for you. In a city, a police officer may make an arrest. They may provide that information to the county attorney for further prosecution. And in that process, at that point in time, they may upload information to the FBI database as relates to that arrest. But there is no funding at the state or federal level for police officers or people within law enforcement to go back and then upload information to the FBI as to whether a conviction happened. So in the testimony provided by the Department of Justice, more than half the information in the FBI database, we don't know whether there is a subsequent conviction to that arrest. That has significant impacts, especially when you're talking about 92 million Americans have either an arrest or criminal conviction in their background. And then unfortunately, because of practices in other areas, we have a disproportionate impact on minority communities, particularly African Americans and Latinos, because they typically get arrested at a higher percentage or a higher rate. So we then have the potential of exacerbating employment disparities which exist for African Americans and Latinos. Recently in the Twin Cities, Dr. Algernon Austin from the Economic Policy Institute published a report which said that the greatest disparity between whites and African Americans among major metropolitan cities in the United States is the Twin Cities area. We have a higher rate than any other major metropolitan area. And as it relates to individuals who are Latinos, we have the fifth highest among all major metropolitan areas. So this has a significant impact as it relates to our state and the growth in opportunities for employment for individuals. And just to dovetail quickly as it relates to the changing demographics, again, if every day in America 10,000 individuals turn 65, we're having a change going on within the demographics as it relates to the people who are leaving our workforce and the people who are entering in. The number from Susan Brower, the state demographer, 10 out of 11 Minnesotans over the age of 55 identify themselves as white, not of Hispanic origin. So to the extent that we are limiting ability of individuals who have an arrest that may never have led to a conviction has a significant economic impact on job availability for individuals and for employers to find qualified people to do their work. That's why it's critically important to just simply move the question from the application to a later point in time in the employment process. This is not preventing an employer from finding out the information and withholding a job, but just simply delaying the process. And that is important to at least get the person that foot in the door.
Commissioner, just looking at the bill, how are you going to let private employers know the change in the law?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have already been in conversation and hosting education seminars as it relates to employers once the EEOC guidance came out in April of last year. So this will be part and parcel of sort of what our traditional education campaign. Personally, I probably have given 7 or 8 presentations on the invitation of various law firms where they have had their clients there, and this has been part of the discussion surrounding this. And I anticipate that at the largest employment conference, which is held here in St. Paul, we have a lot of employers, over 1,000 that come to the River Center, that I will be asked this question on the presentation scheduled for late April.
Very good. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of questions on this bill. I know that the intent's good. I know that we want to give people a second chance, and I totally support that. But I have heard from small business owners. They've voiced their concerns. They're limited on time. They're limited on resources. They can't afford to do the background checks and everything. And they just, you know, they just have restrictions. It's not like they're a big multinational company that maybe can say, yeah, this is fine. Okay? So there's lots of exceptions for small businesses in Minnesota. The Affordable Care Act gives exceptions for companies that have less than 50 employees. Current minimum wage bills give exceptions for small businesses who because they understand there's a cost and that they struggle just to make ends meet. So the first thing I'd like to say is I'd ask the author to possibly amend this bill to give some opening or more flexibility for smaller businesses. The second thing is I heard Mr. Hasse say that a lot of companies already do this. They say, you know what, I'm not going to worry about this. Let's have the interview first. And that's a choice. And that's freedom, and that's free market, and that's businesses making a decision if this is maybe one of their missions, that they want to help people and give them a second chance. I think this should be a choice, not a mandate. So those are my comments right now. And then I'm looking at the subsection 3, subdivision 1, and it says, any complaints or grievances, that worries me. I don't know what that means, any complaints or grievances.
Where was that, Representative Kiefer?
Section 3, subdivision 1. Okay. And line 2.1.
Okay, got it.
Any complaint? I mean, that just opens a door. And then on the private employers, we've got the Commissioner of Human Rights investigating. I don't know why this wouldn't be through the Department of Labor or our deed. And it just kind of sends up red flags for me that this could be very subjective and start to target these small businesses. Those are my concerns. I'd be happy to have anyone address it, or if the author wants to talk to me offline about a possible amendment. Thank you.
Representative members of the committee?
Commissioner.
I'm sorry. There is nothing which compels an employer to do a criminal background check within this bill. So the choice still remains for an employer whether they wish to conduct a criminal background history or not. As to flexibility as relates to small employers, within the Senate committee, there was questions concerning the imposition of a potential fine. And the discussion there was, should more discretion be given to the commissioner to have it, instead of an all or nothing $500 fine, to make it such that I could have discretion to impose potentially a smaller fine given the size of the employer. And I think to that extent, if it was a very small employer which did not have an HR staff or did not have legal staff, it doesn't compel me necessarily to impose a fine. As it relates to where it is housed concerning the Department of Labor or for the Department of Human Rights, I would submit that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has published and has been more leading in the way at the federal level than the Department of Labor on this respective issue. So I think if you were to mirror sort of the federal level, it probably would be housed more appropriately within the Department of Human Rights as opposed to the Department of Labor. In conversation with Commissioner Peterson on this respective issue, our department has had more conversations with employers on this issue than the Department of Labor.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kiefer.
Okay, I understand that they're not compelled to give a background check, but suppose it is a small business where they feel they want to do this, but it's not really within the law already. I don't know. Maybe it's carpet cleaners, and they go into homes, and they need to hire the carpet cleaners. Well, now, if they can ask them up front, then they know, and then they can have the discussion. But if they can't ask up front, now they are going to have to do some kind of background check, possibly. So I just want to make sure that we're really thinking clearly and not putting more mandates and increasing the cost of doing business in Minnesota again, because we're looking at this all over the board in all of my committees. We're finding ways to increase costs on this and this and this and more regulations, and just really, like I said, the intent is good. I want to help people. I think Second Chance Coalition and Network for Better Futures are great organizations. But I also want to make sure that we're being a strong voice for the small businessman and woman in Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
Representative
Mahoney.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, happy to talk with you this afternoon at any time between now and this getting to the floor about a small business exemption. But having said that, there's no requirement for a small business to do a criminal background check. The only thing this says is that they can't ask this on their application. They can ask it over the phone when they call. They can ask it in person. Do you have a? Have you been arrested? Have you? Do you have a conviction? Have you had anything? They can ask that at any time. They just cannot. Once they have made the call to anyone asking, would you like to come in and do an interview? But by the way, if you have a criminal or arrest record, do you have one? And they can ask that and then say, you know what, no, don't come in. So it's not asking people to do a criminal background check.
Okay. Just one more quick comment. Then that's good, but let's still recognize that the employer has to make the phone call. And so that is time. Even if it takes 10 minutes, let's not be disrespectful of the employer's time. And then also, if they do ask on the phone, I go back to this any complaint part, and it bothers me a little bit because maybe whoever gets that phone call and they say, hey, do you have any criminal history? And they go, yeah, and then the discussion stops or something, and so they feel like were treated unfairly on the phone, on the initial phone call, and they put in the complaint. Now we get the Human Rights Department coming in, spending a couple of hours talking to them. Now we're talking more time. So do you see where I'm going? These are my concerns.
Commissioner, you want to answer that? I also think that I think that subdivision you're referring to is in current law.
Can I clarify the language, Mr. Chair?
Tahasi.
On the public, looking at 2.10 that Representative Kiefer is referring to, and 2.11, it says that public employers, and maybe the commissioner could respond to this also, but the complaints or grievances concerning the overall chapter is related to public employers, and then it switches to private employers, where then the investigator would investigate violations just of this ban the box piece, so just of the removing from the application. I don't know if that helps. You know, it's just clarification of that question. I understand Representative Kiefer's other concerns.
Commissioner, did you want to respond to, or we have three members who would wish to have questions.
Mr. Chair and Representative, very briefly, to the extent that a private employer in your scenario wishes to undertake a criminal background check, they would have the ability to do so. And I would submit to you that with passage of this, there's probably going to be more of a comprehensive discussion as to those best practices for that employer in that situation. Because currently, right now, when I have conversations with small employers, they are not receiving that type of information as to how to conduct criminal background check. And I say that not just simply in my current position as commissioner, but as someone who represented small businesses for over 20 years, and have provided seminars on this particular topic. This is not something in which a lot of small employers have that background unless they do reach out to someone to provide them with that information.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk, if I could, about making sure I understand the language on line 3.27. That says it doesn't supersede requirements to do specific checks for specific hiring of specific types of employment. You know, it would be helpful to know what those are in here. So I don't know if we have I assume we don't have a sort of carpet cleaning example, but I would assume there's a law on the books, for example, for nursery schools or preschools doing screening as to past offenses against children. So I assume this means what it appears to mean, which is this wouldn't this wouldn't touch that. Is there a comprehensive list somewhere? I mean, it doesn't have to be right now, so that we can know what it doesn't touch, all those provisions that this generically refers to. I assume there are many in state statute where for particular jobs there has to be a background check. That would certainly give me comfort.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Simon, Mr. Chair, and members of this committee, that would be quite an extensive list to be put together. So I think the language was very broad to ensure that all jobs which either at the federal level or state level would be covered. I could direct you to language within the Department of Human Services as relates to the provisions there, which would be excluded. We had individuals from, I believe, the police department or in state patrol. Those all would be identified. There's a litany. Yeah. So, go ahead.
Can I, Mr. Haas, maybe I just ask Haas Research to respond to that. Okay. Mr. Debo, can you?
Mr. Chair, members, Haas Research has a publication with all mandated background check statutes, both listed and described, so I'd be happy to provide that to Representative Simon and any other member that's interested.
Yeah, well, why don't you just provide, is it huge?
Mr. Chair, members, it's pretty lengthy.
Representative Simon,
I was just,
have it.
You know, I'm not saying for right now, but thank you, Mr. Diebel, I appreciate that. And then I'm wondering, too, I know we only have a few minutes left, but
that's okay. We'll go a little bit over. So
well, I do see other. I don't want to put him on the spot, but I see Mr. Gerber from the chamber. I'm interested to hear what the perspective is of either the chamber or others from the business community, whether what they think about this.
Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Representative Simon, for asking the question. I thought I was going to get away with not testifying today, but you know, we still have concerns with this bill, but I think we realize, you know, we tried to work with the authors and Representative Mahoney and some of the others have been really receptive to Senator Champion, to some of the concerns that we have, and I think our greatest concern was the potential for litigation. I mean, I think we see, you know, from the business community's perspective, a lot of mandates coming down and potential cost increases to employers from things that may not have been heard in this committee or may have. And so this was one way where we thought we could actually still, you know, help mitigate some of our concerns. They're not totally erased, but then also address the concerns that Representative Mahoney and the Second Chance Coalition had. And so we think that we work with them and they work with us in good faith, and hopefully that answered your question.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Mahoney, I just to give some of the comfort level why I voted real quickly for this or why I'm going to vote for it and why I'm a co-author is I've been talking to Second Chance Coalition for this about a number of years, and even I think Right on Crime, a fairly conservative think tank with Newt Gingrich is involved with, has approved of this and realized that when people get out of prison, one of the quickest ways they would get into trouble is if they don't get a job and have some type of employment. And then there's other things in here that I think Representative Kiefer's point was, when you can ask somebody over the phone if they got a criminal record, then you know, because they know if they're lying. But if you can ask them, then they have to do a background check to find that out. It's not that they're compelled to, it's that they feel they have to because they can't ask a person, and that's the cost. But I think most of my fears have been taken away by that one statute that you talked about. Everybody that's mandated to do a background check from law enforcement on to everybody else is already taken care of. And you still can ask, a small employer can still ask a person. It's just that if they put out a application procedure, they can't have a box on it. And when you get them to the first interview, if I'm a small employer, I'm going to call somebody in for an interview. I'm not just going to hire them over the phone. But once you get to that interview, you can ask them if they've got a criminal record. So with that, this mitigated over the years from where it first started out. That gave me more of a comfort level to vote for it. So thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, most of my questions have been answered.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Representative Mahoney, do you want to sum it up?
In a to be respectful to your time, Mr. Chair, this is a good bill. I think it really will help in the future in many, many ways. So please vote for it and pass it to the floor.
Very good. So the chair will renew his motion that House File 690 be passed and referred to the General Register. Any discussion? And I didn't ask. Is there anyone who opposes the bill that didn't or wants to speak in favor of the bill? Keep forgetting to ask that. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.